Do you have a link to document for topic at all?
Yeah, it's the one in the subject of the room.
Oh, gotcha. Subject of the room. We're not on IRC, Paul.
Oh, shut the fuck up. It's a channel on IRC anyway, not a room.
Well, howdy, folks. It's Friday, and we are drunk and retired.
Where am I? What's going on?
I don't know where I got room from. What's that, like ICQ or?
Oh yeah, it was ICQ.
Second Life or something.
Okay, so
did you know that the people actually still use ICQ and people sell like the low digit numbers? Like, there's an actual market for low. Like, you can buy them on eBay, which is bonkers.
That is pretty rough. Speaking of Second Life, did you see the thread on Twitter yesterday about the DevOps conference that's going to be held inside of Animal Crossing?
No, that's brilliant.
It is so Second Life. Yeah, because someone actually jokingly said, at least we're not hosting it in Second Life. Then someone else showed up to talk about how great Second Life is.
Yeah.
Inviting a vampire in when you start bringing up Second Life.
Well, right. Well, you know, IBM did actually run a conference in Second Life at one time. It did actually happen. There's an internal joke at IBM about, like, well, we can't do conferences anymore. What are we going to do? Somebody said Second Life, and they're like, we've already tried that. And there was just people put their hands in their head, like, wait a second, what? So, yeah.
Your head in your hand is kind of a go-to way to sit in a meeting at IBM, going from past experience.
We don't have Kote today, or this one, because if you don't know, he had a baby.
A wee baby.
Yeah, there's some good pictures out there.
That's my cute voice. Don't expect to hear it too often.
We've all been working from home for a little while, and we're all kind of going to the point where, I don't know, like, we have to collaborate. And I can't just walk over to somebody's cube. Well, I never did because I always work from home, but you get my point. And we have ways we need to communicate and work together. So we're going to talk about a little bit about using Google Docs or shared docking systems today, because we're most of us, I mean, there are some people, some crazy people out there who use this thing called Live or Office 365, I think. Like,
We don't need to talk about those people.
Okay.
In the same way, we wouldn't be bringing up Verse or LibreOffice 365 or whatever version is.
Hey, we're only using Etherpad in the open source community, so I'd like you all to join me there.
Yes, openstack.etherpad.org still exists.
Oh, I'm sorry for your loss.
So collaboration, right? Like, we have to collaborate on docs. We have to work together. I lean towards Google Docs. Almost when I come up, like, hell, our notes for this podcast are in Google Docs, right? It's just something that just works. And it's just, it's beautiful because people can comment, collaborate, and that resolve, when somebody clicks that resolve, it's like the big green button on GitHub, right? Like, it just feels good.
Yeah, Gigi, I'm with you in theory and sometimes in practice. So you said the green resolve button. So are you saying, like, are you a fan of suggestion mode? Because I think suggestion mode is such a wonderfully controversial topic.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take that. Do you, when you share a doc with somebody, did you force them into comment mode, or do you give them edit rights?
Oh, that's, so I'll be honest and say I default to edit mode.
Really?
Because I believe in my ability to navigate Google Docs, and since they give you a full history of edits, I can always just back out your edits. Like, it's like in the back of my head, there's a very cocky little person that's just saying, like, I know Google Docs well enough to not let you screw this up for me. And by default, it's also, you know, you just get people's ideas out faster. I think I don't like mailing lists for the same reason I don't want 100 comments all over my Google Doc. Mm. Like, just let's just clean this up together and move forward. I don't need that.
I feel like that's just because you feel like you need to inject one of the freedoms into your workflow. And so at least giving people the freedom to just type shit into a browser is probably a good start.
Is that one of the four freedoms of free software?
I don't know.
Well, it's like, you know, you have the seven old wonders of the world. Like, maybe right? We have like the four new freedoms of the internet. And one is that I get edit mode by default in your Google Docs. Yes, almost nothing about that is free software, but I'm going to give that to you as a privilege.
That's right. I do it depending on who I'm sharing with. Like, if I'm sharing with people like I know and have done stuff with before, totally go straight to edit mode. But if I'm sharing it with little Joey Bob and want him to just see how I do a particular thing, I will put it in comment or suggestion mode and let them go that way. And that gives me a little bit of control. I feel like if you're doing like a wider audience, like group thing at work, you should probably use suggestion mode. Mm-hmm. If you're doing something for your team or for your friends, just go straight to edit mode. If you all can't work together in like a live editing environment, then you probably shouldn't be on a team together. You've got to be at least this tall to ride. You got to be at least this tool to ride.
This tools.
Okay. All right. So yeah, I agree. The circles of trust. It's a good default kind of way to do a lot of things in general. Like, for instance, we obviously have edit mode in ours right now. We don't put comments because I think that would just be a dick move, to be honest with you.
Now, I think we're missing a demographic here, and that is we're talking about collaborating with people at work. Mm. But people are suddenly experiencing this thing where they have an entire family of people at home all day, every day. So, JJ, as our local person that has kids on this podcast today, have you found yourself reaching for using things like Google Docs and other shared services in recent times that you wouldn't have before?
So over the winter break, we ripped out Dropbox completely from our family, and we moved solely to Google Drive. Turns out 2 terabytes on Google Drive was comparable to what we were spending on Dropbox. And we started like dumping all our information and all our stuff into a shared family Google Drive. And like we have even the thing that no one ever keeps track of where all the power comes in, the box, the little switches. The hell's a
breaker box? Meter, the breaker box.
Nobody ever knows what
we're
all
good at computers, folks. Yeah. Not electricity.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody ever knows what those switches do, right? Like when you're like, I need to change out a light bulb. You'd shut the power down to the whole house, don't you? I mean, come on, right? So the first document we did was actually created a spreadsheet inside of it and walked through the house, hitting every single switch to figure out what everything was, and now. On Google Drive, we have it everywhere. Where I'm just like, oh shit, we have a problem on in the office. Click. Oh, I don't have someone yelling on the other side of the house saying, "Daddy, you switched off the internet." Well, in the office, it's in the internet, but you get the point. And it's good stuff, right? Like to start streamlining all that information in one location. Also, my daughter, who is a third grader,
you better know, not us.
I got to think about this stuff.
Yeah, sure.
She actually uses Google Classroom in her school.
Oh, cool. I've heard good things about that. Like, it's actually a pretty tight environment where it's easy to assign things and to grade it all for people that have worse jobs than us, which are teachers. Thank you for doing that if you're a teacher and listening. I'm also sorry you have to listen to this.
Yes.
But that's cool. So she's pretty used to Google Drive then.
Like she has her whole like world. Like one of the first things she did when I gave her a real Gmail account was that she brought up Google Slides and started making a presentation. And I'm like, wait, what are you doing? She's like, this is how I like show things off at school. I'm like,
holy crap.
A
generation defined by slides.
Exactly.
The generation PPTX. Is that the next one? No.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
Gen That's Z's a dated already... reference.
Well, I mean, Matt, when you were a kid, you did the same thing just with overhead projector transparency sheets, right?
Oh, man, those are so classy. Yes, right? I guess I am the youngest here, judging by the gray in one's beard and one's hair.
just because you dye your hair doesn't mean you have to call yourself young.
Dude, I have looked about 10 years younger than my actual age for my entire life, and that's finally a good thing. But like being carded at 25 to 30 was not my favorite, but now it's kind of cool.
Yep. I've always looked 10 years older than I've always been. No joke. My whole life, I had at age 15, I had a full grown goatee. So I was buying beer for my friends. Like, I didn't drink at the time. But I would buy beer for my friends and everything because people would be just like, there's this guy with a massive goatee. Like I should find pictures. It's pretty crazy.
I'm just sad about the goatee, but you know,
unfortunately for his sister, she also had a full grown goatee at 15.
It was weird. Oh, I'm not going to lie.
One more question on the Google Drives. As somebody, JJ, as an adopter across the family, and Paul as a connoisseur of circles of trust, can we just talk about how ironic it is that Google Drive, the creators of the most amazing search engine in the world, have made a file system that is impossible to search for efficiently?
I don't know. I really just use it as a shared file system. I just think of it as using File Explorer in Windows 95 or something, right? I don't really expect anything more than that.
So have you used it in an organization that also has like a shared folder? Because I've done this.
Oh yeah, it's hot garbage. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Because I've had like my personal folder and then there's a shared folder and you have this amazingly bad button that says like add to your shared folder. Mm-hmm. So now I basically have like this, you know, ln-l link from there over to here. And I don't know if it's the same file or not because they don't actually show me.
I also don't cross the streams. Like I have a totally different browser profile for work and one for personal. And so I would never share between them anyway. So of my work docs,
I guess you're just a better person than me.
That is true. I mean, that's an undisputed fact.
So for when I was moving everything from Dropbox, because that's what Dropbox was, it became just a cluster of just files that we had between the family. So when I moved it to a shared folder between me and my wife, who had our separate accounts that were connected to the family, and we had that shared one, I was actually able to pull all my stuff out of it and put it in my private space. And then she could pull all her stuff out. We actually had the... what is it? Not intersection, but reverse intersection of whatever that the collection of files were.
Yeah, the opposite of a union.
Yeah, the opposite of a union. Yeah, and it worked really well. And now I have like an IBM folder in there. I have an old Chef folder in there because when I worked at Chef, I had a bunch of stuff. That's amazing. And it's just it requires discipline, like to use Google Drive effectively. It requires discipline. There was a great joke about and Chef software when I used it there was that as long as it was in Drive, it was valid, right?
Yeah.
And to your point, when you had that weird symlink that didn't actually do anything and you tried to copy that file to be like, I make an edit. Wait, you look at the upstream version. There's no changes here. I don't know what's going on. And it became a joke. So. Yeah. We ended up actually slacking the message back or slacking the we pull it off of Drive. We had to make changes. We change it back and forth through a Slack message or whatever, and then send it back up to Drive on top of it to make sure the owner would actually do basically the Git merge of it. That makes sense.
I think you just nailed it, JJ. Like this is where my actual gripe, like the kernel of gripeness, if you will, it's that Google Drive does not replace project management. Yes. And I want to pretend it does because you just want to make a file for everything. You make a file for notes, you make a file for your project proposals and requests for proposals and like collaboration docs. And then you have them all. And then it's like, okay, you can search and find them if you know the keywords, but like, where's the perspective on what you've done? Like what atrocities are hiding in Google Drive that like are actually just a poorly managed project? I'd say a lot.
And I believe the search doesn't even do searching in like PDFs or things, right? So if you put a PDF up there and it had the word supercalifragilistic, well, no, that's a bad example because I didn't even say
it. Yeah, try that again.
Yeah, not even gonna try. Project X, let's just call it Project X. And you were like, hey, this is our project proposal for this. And you went to Google Drive search, to your point about the best search engine on the planet. It still can't find that file for you. If it's named Project X, it might come up. But I don't think it actually reads inside of it. Am I wrong?
I don't know that's entirely true. I have certainly found documents from the contents. I'm not 100% sure I found PDFs from the contents. But don't forget that PDFs come in several forms. Some of them are like images, like they've scanned in a document. Right?
Oh, good.
And
good point.
Some of them are coming from like printing a document to PDF. Mm-hmm. And I think usually the latter is stored in some sort of more rich thing that allows you to search through them. Whereas the former is just an image that's in a document, right? So unless you did some sort of OCR in the middle, then it's not really searchable, even from a PDF viewer. So, some manuals OCR and stuff.
What's OCR? Really? No, I'm kidding.
Okay. Well, I mean, tell it for the guests or the poor listeners.
I don't know what it stands for. Something recognition.
Yeah. I actually knew this. Shit.
it's the thing what looks at text and tells you what words it is.
Oh, so I had to Google it. It's optical character recognition.
Wow. You got it.
Yeah. I mostly just wanted to keep subscribing to the Paul Explains PDFs podcast because the alliteration is fantastic. And also PDFs are not as trivial as we think they are.
Right. Let's talk about LaTeX for a little while. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
I have a LaTeX allergy.
Yeah. That was awesome. That was amazing.
Moving along.
I save all my documents in sheet casing.
Oh, God.
Well, that was only the sausage you make at home.
Hey.
So speaking of anything else, we're talking about working from home, and we'd be remiss not to mention the incredibly stable application we're using to do so, which is called Zoom. For those unfamiliar with it, it's the video conferencing application that the whole world is using now. And it has some, you can disagree with me. I think it's been stable as all heck. And it also offers virtual backgrounds, which we're abusing, which are pretty funny.
Hold on. Two things. First of all, everyone's still using WebEx. Don't lie. Nothing. Okay. Sorry. IBM are over here. And second, did you know that the virtual backgrounds only work, or at least they only work on Macs and Windows. They do not work on the Linux distribution of Zoom, or at least the last time I had it when I had it on my laptop. Yeah.
I feel like you're trolling me. I'm going to grab my Fedora laptop to the right here and see if that's true.
Now we're all distracted trying to.
Yeah. When people had it first come out, they were like, they were all showing it off, and I was still on my Fedora laptop, and I was like, what's that? They even have like reactions and stuff.
Oh, wait. What was happening on my background there?
Well, you're on a MacBook, so,
No, I'm not.
Yeah, you are. Don't lie to me. What's up, really?
I promise you, I'm on my Linux box.
What do you run, Paul? I'm curious.
I run Ubuntu, I think I'm at 1910 with XFCE as the window manager.
The worst acronym, but an actually pretty cool Windows manager.
Right.
Yeah.
Open box for the win.
GNOME is solid.
Yeah,
Stick with the classics. Anywho, so Zoom, while we invalidate JJ's point on exclusivity of backgrounds, any thoughts, feels on us living our entire lives through this platform now, Paul?
Yeah, so there's definitely been some folks talking about maybe previous shady practices of Zoom. There was a pretty good blog post a day or two ago that went through a few of the things, and I don't have it up in front of me because I'm not a very well-prepared person. But certainly one of the things was, first of all, it's not end-to-end encrypted. So in theory, someone could look at our stream and figure out what's going on if they knew the protocols.
But what's the little padlock mean?
That's just to make you feel better about it. There was some technicalities between encryption versus encryption.
That's funny.
It does say
your client connection is encrypted, which makes me feel comfortable, but does not imply end-to-end.
So it's ROT 13, correct, basically? Or just running ROT
13? Yeah, so it might be just like from me to the Zoom server is encrypted, but maybe through the Zoom server it's not, and then it's re-encrypted to go back out to Matt.
Wow.
I don't know, but yeah, you'd have to read the article. It did talk about the detail of that. There was also some talk about there had some weird practices where they were actually hacking the Mac installer so that it wouldn't ask you for your super user password when you were installing it. And I think Mac actually had to release a patch to block them from doing it. Mm-hmm. So it's just some behaviors like that that make people think maybe they're not a super virtuous company that does the right thing, but then they're a company. They're not supposed to be virtuous. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the whole point of capitalism, is to extract to extract money from people and give it to other people, mm-hmm, right?
It's a certain blend of it. I think it's a late capitalism interpretation,
right?
But
you're gonna get the capitalism you're in.
Get the capitalism you want, you get the capitalism, right, you're in.
They were also sending tracking information to Facebook at one point of all calls
at the same time. All right I've worked in the corporate America a good portion of my life. The best advice or the best statement I've ever heard is a temporary fix is the best permanent solution. Right. So somebody probably picked up some library that did 95% of the work they needed. And they're like, we'll just throw it in here to get that stuff done. Oh, it's send stuff off to Facebook. Not a big deal. Let's just walk away. No one's going to ever look at this. And then all of a sudden, literally everyone's eyes are now on Zoom. Like that pun? No? Okay. And it was, now we're actually looking at it. I will say, though, that I think it was the 7-zip idea of them like injecting 7-zip to use to extract their binary to install it on Mac, if I'm correctly, that was like the technical details of it. I got to admit, that's pretty clever, like across the board. If you actually look at the way Mac is, like, you take your little app and you drag and drop it, right? And that's usually the interface of getting an app installed on a Mac. There's still a lot of code there if you really dig into it. And not everyone has a way to extract software. And then you're not going to want to force people to use 7-zip and have to install that as a prerequisite. But it's brilliant what they did is they did this pre-install script that brought it all down, did it, and then actually cleaned itself up. If you look again, I can see that project manager and those developers in the little conference room being like, oh, Jesus, how do we get this thing on everyone's laptop? Because we have this tarball here, and we can't actually do it. So what do? We'll just, kick the tire down the, or kick the can down the road. No one's ever going to look at this. Wait a second. So I can see how they got to this point. I can. That's the long-winded way of saying it.
That's fair, man. That's
Actually, what you just said a second ago reminded me a little bit of Hanlon's Razor. If you're familiar with it, which is never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by stupidity.
Or efficiency, quote unquote.
Or efficiency. Yeah, I think the similar saying, which actually came, I think, from Robert Heinlein, was, I think, used incompetence instead of stupidity. So it was don't attribute to malice when it's adequately explained by incompetence.
Yeah, speaking of incompetence, Paul, you had a hot take. That kind of relates back to maybe our core audience and our lives. What was on your mind?
Yeah, so I guess my hot take was around telling developers that they need to understand operations and that just means you're a bad operator.
Well, like let's walk us through this. Like, isn't DevOps this idea that developers are now operators and operators are now developers? Isn't that like the whole truth of it, right?
It's a culture thing, not a
I mean that's it's not really the whole truth of it. And the problem is, of course, the DevOps folks refuse to have an official definition, so therefore you can just define it however the fuck you want. Mm-hmm. But I guess where I'm trying to get to with this is we should be trying to reduce the cognitive load on people that is required for them to do their job, right? And so telling them they not only need to know how to write some Java, but they also need to understand how everything is done in operations, how to, you know, automate stuff using Chef, and how to deploy to servers, and how to appropriately set up an Amazon VPC and do the appropriate security things and use the right IAMs and don't expose your S3 buckets to the entire internet. That's a lot of cognitive overhead. To me, that's something that like an operations team should be handling and providing as some sort of contract to the developers. Like in the same way that like we're supposed to be developing software as microservices, where you have an API, which is the contract for those microservices to talk to each other. And that way you don't need to know the entire inner workings of the other team's login app. You just need to know like the contract to it. And often you get like even a testable thing, so you can actually test that contract. And I feel like that's where we should have been going with operations, is providing those contracts. And so the developer doesn't need to know how to write Chef. They need to know how to interact with the Chef that's been put together by the operations team or the platform team or the DevOps team or whatever you want to call them. And I feel like that's kind of more the SRE way of doing things, is maybe having that some sort of contractual thing. Although a lot of their contracts are around whether you're allowed to write new code or you have to focus on stability versus the actual, you know, who owns what components.
Cool. Well, I think you laid down the gauntlet. JJ, what's your take?
So the short of what it's a double-edged sword, right? Like I was a senior DevOps engineer at a previous company, right? Like I understand. Like
I can tell by the length and color of your beard.
It's true.
By your Unix admin.
There you go. Got my free BSD box behind me. Anyway, so I'm starting to come around to the concept of what Paul was saying there for a second, where especially in the worlds that I'm playing in and talking to the enterprises that I'm talking to, it's actually really hard to talk to a Java developer who's only ever spent their whole lives playing around in the Java JVM and writing code in Java, and then tell them, okay, we're going to start talking about how IBM cloud works because it's the best cloud to do things. Nothing really. Okay. I tried.
It's not worth it.
That's right. Okay. Not even acknowledgement. Awesome.
what did they say? You can't fight stupid.
Hey, but okay. So to spend the time and effort to show like them Terraform, to be able to spin up your infrastructure to get that them going, and all they've ever spent their lives doing is Java. To Paul's point, that's a massive, massive leap of ways. And if you don't have the drive to do it, then you're not gonna want to. You're not gonna take the effort. Now there needs to be a people that sit in the middle of that Venn diagram between the Java developer and your ecosystem that you run your application on, who wants to understand that. And I think it's an opt-in kind of situation, right? You need to have a practice around it so people can opt in to learn as much as they want to learn, but they need to be able to, they need to be able to opt out if they don't want to. So for instance, like OpenShift is a great example of this, where OpenShift gives you some amazing guardrails to run your application on Kubernetes. Unfortunately, in a lot of ecosystems, it's a pretty high price to pay to get those guardrails, right? I'm not going to lie. And it's one of those situations where if I was just a Java developer and I had that jar file, or no, war file, and I wanted to ship and run it, right? If I just gave it and did OC run WAR file, and it just went up to OpenShift, and my new version was already out there, and everything just kind of happened. I mean, it's a little bit more complex than that, but let's just bear with me. That is really valuable to that person who has opted out. But you still need people who sit there and understand how OpenShift works on top of Kubernetes to be able to understand Kubernetes to make sure that it gives the business value to the whole company.
Does an operations team.
It's almost like we needed a wall of confusion team because we had the ops team, we had the dev team, and we just need to bring together the people in the middle under a title.
Yeah. Well, we don't need the team in the middle. What we need instead of a wall of confusion is we need a wall of contract. Right?
So, on the seven DevOps ago.
Yeah, exactly.
On the developer side of the wall, you have like what the operations team expects and provides. And then the operations team side of the wall, you have what the developers expect and provide. Right? And that way you know. And it's the same, like we used to have like DBA teams. And if you needed to know anything about, like as a Java developer, if you needed to know about how to write an efficient query based on the data set you have, you had that expertise to like reach into. Like who even has DBA teams anymore? Like nobody, right? And so instead, you just insert coins into like Amazon's RDS service until it gives you the performance you want. Using whichever language ORM you're using. You're not actually, like, there's not a lot of making things more efficient in the code side of things because everyone's gotten so used to, especially after, like, so many years of, like, growth. It's just easier to keep inserting money into the, like, Amazon or Google money box and getting more services than it is to actually go back and, like, make things more efficient, actually use things more appropriately.
I'm going to say something pretty controversial, but something I truly believe, which is traditionally, and I'm putting air quotes up on a audio podcast, which I realize doesn't work very well. When you were a developer, right, you probably went to school as a, in general, I'm making very general statements here. You probably went to school to go get your comp sci degree or your computer engineering degree, and you had a very traditional path. On the other side, operations was almost like a vocation, right? Where you were the sysadmin, you were you started probably maybe out of high school or maybe in the middle of college, and you may not have even finished college, right? But you were experienced through the streets, if you will.
Like yeah, you went to the school of hard knocks.
Exactly, and over time, obviously. The lines have crossed, right, or whatever. I mean, actually, it has. There's a lot of people who are coming out not through traditional university college routes, and they're going the other way. Well, DevOps engineers are now going back to school because they're like, oh, I need to all know, understand what, like, you know, how computers actually work. So it's interesting how it's coming, doing that little crossing pattern. But I think what we're in is a culture, like, as a industry, we're having this, is all of a sudden like realization that we all have the same skill sets. It's just specialization, right? And where you fit in that gradient, right? You have the, I just sit in Java all day. Oh, I want to go rack servers all night kind of thing. Gradient. I mean, I'm making very general statements again, but there's a gradient and every person has a skill set that fits there. And there are some people who have larger skill sets. Like what is that? T-shaped engineer. Right, is a perfect example. You have someone who has a really wide swath and they focus on one thing. And there's also the I-shaped engineer that I came up with, which is I'm only stuck on one line of that gradient. And anyway, they're usually very I-centric. But anyway, what I'm trying to get at is I genuinely believe that we still live in this world and we're just trying to find a way to quantify it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. So I think from my perspective, it's that not all software developers need to be operations, but mm-hmm. probably all or almost all of operations need to be software developers. Because in order to provide those contracts to each other, we need to basically build a platform. And you can tack most of that platform together using existing parts, see Kubernetes and things we put on top of it. But at some point, to get a really good, efficient, opinionated platform for your company, you need to actually put some pieces together. So you either need, I guess maybe your operations team don't need to code. Certainly they need to be able to use like Chef or Puppet or Helm or whatever automation tooling you're using. But there needs to be that kind of middle, like that operations middleware that takes that unopinionated set of platforms you've glued together and turn it into an opinionated platform that builds and runs software exactly how your organization wants them to build and run.
I think it's fair to say, like, to go back to your very first point, that it's like, how do we reduce the cognitive load, especially on developers, through great operations practices? I think like the meta thing that we all have to agree to is that cognitive load is increasing exponentially. It is difficult to conceive of these systems that we're building. You know, cue any good talk on resiliency engineering that's out there. There's a ton of them. So we can't honestly understand and internalize all of it. So everyone, I feel like everyone's kind of going up in like having to understand more of the cognitive load of building an application structurally. But I fully agree with your conclusion that like there's more onus on operators getting out of that single silo that used to be a huge moneymaker and a huge value. Like I know Unix systems or I know Windows systems. And like, that is my thing. I don't do networking. I don't do storage. I certainly don't code. Like we have to, I think there's like a reclamation of this idea of like, what does it mean to be a developer? Like every freaking person in ops has written a conditional statement and use Bash or use like C Sharp or .NET to do something interesting. And that is software development. Like, yeah, maybe you're not good at abstracting and writing perfectly modular code, but like accept the fact that you already are a bit of a developer. And I love where you brought it, JJ, on like we're on this continuum. Not everyone needs to be a cookie cutter where they're either the metaphorical op or the metaphorical dev. Mm-hmm. Like there will be ranges and there will certainly be a ridiculous number of titles in that space. But like, yeah, I'm really interested to see if this continues to shake out. My favorite model so far has been, you know, shifting what used to be ops into a platform team, shifting what used to be dev into dev. Like they're still freaking developers and that's their primary role. And then you have an SRE team that spans the gap in a meaningful way and can write that glue code or that opinionated code as you're talking about. But then like, yeah, especially adopt people from dev and ops who are really interested in it and like start to span that gap. I don't know. Anyone else see models that they're interested in or like team?
Yeah, that's kind of the model I see, except I feel like you said a platform team and then an SRE team on top of that.
Yeah. Separate ones.
I feel like the platform team probably in like envelops SRE.
Oh, cool.
I'm thinking of a couple
companies in mind that have like separate SRE teams that kind of work like internal consultants. Like they embed in a development team for a while and they're outside of ops, but they're like collaborative with ops. I thought that was a really cool, maybe I'm talking like, you know, 10,000 plus people scale right. Companies.
Yep.
And I saw some really cool results from that.
So they're almost working as coaches to teach development teams on how to use the platform.
Yeah, and they're being embedded developers, but they're developing operational efficiencies in that team while also training and coaching them through that. So the goal is that they're not permanently embedded. They actually have like a strict contract of, you know, whether it's a 2-week sprint or a 6-week one. But like you explicitly define what you're trying to get to and you get them to it. And then the goal is for that dev team to have some more operational awareness, but not have to start from zero on their own.
Yes. I think
that's the terrifying thing.
That probably takes me to what I think is my final thought on like my initial statement. And that is developers don't need to be operations, but they do need to know how their software works and operates on top of the platform they're provided. because they really are the ones who should be responsible for the uptime of it, et cetera, if it is a application level problem. So they need to be able to determine if it's application level or infrastructure level. So they do need to know enough about operations. And I guess that's maybe the problem is where we don't have a good platform for them to use. All of the other garbage is the platform they have to use, and therefore they kind of have to learn all of that other garbage. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have a good operations team, your development team has to know more operations to make up the gap.
I still like Capistrano. And
on that note, look at the time. Wow.
You know what? You know what? Let's bring us to a close on a softer subject. I don't know about you all, but I'm noticing more and more links to articles I'm interested in coming, not just from your traditional Hacker News, which we all love to hate or hate to love or any combination of the two. But yeah, have you seen lobsters? And not like the red creatures that we eat and after boiling to death. I mean like the website that seems to be a spinoff.
I've seen it, but I've never really paid any attention to it. But then I also don't really pay any attention to Hacker News or Reddit or Fucked Company or all those other internet websites you read.
Well, for me, I try to find a way to get news from multiple sources. And if it pops up on multiple different websites, then I give it the benefit of the doubt of something real happening. Lobsters I came across a while ago, and I have a -5 reputation on it right now because I accidentally
the IBM cloud's going over well there.
yeah, I accidentally put like a business like an announcement that I thought was relative to a conversation, and they're like, no sales stuff in this, and I got downvoted to hell on it, and oof. You can't seem to come back up from that. So I'm just kind of like passively reading it now. But the point being is when I was part of that community before I got kicked out, it actually is, it's much more technical in my opinion than Hacker News, because Hacker News feels like, I'm going to use this term very roughly, but very tech bro-y, right? Where I feel sometimes that there's not exactly positivity in Hacker News by any standard.
You're not saying anything that's breaking anyone's mind. Yeah, definitely a Silicon Valley centric version of technology on Hacker News.
That's just any like social graph on the internet, right? Always swings straight to the worst qualities of whoever is in that social graph.
And luckily, the people of Hacker News haven't found lobsters yet. In general. Like there are some really good technical, really deep technical conversations, especially for an Emacs user like me. And like I learned stuff that I'd never thought of looking through the comments. Believe it or not, I read the comments, yes, on lobsters. So it's well worth it, in my opinion.
That's super cool. I've been toying around with lobster a little bit myself. I saw that more articles from opensource.com are getting cross-posted there, and there's a little traffic trickling in. Oddly enough, after Google, the second most popular third-party reference comes from Flipboard. Flipboard is, to this day, an exceptional aggregator of information. At least it's getting out to a very large audience for the kind of Linux and Kubernetes and programming language-centric stuff I post. So kind of amazing. I still use it a little, but I'm into lobster. I'm not against it. I like that it's named after a delicious animal, and it looks minimalist and straightforward. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you're having a good experience with it.
It's open source also, and so they've actually released it on GitHub, the core product or the core underlying technology. And there have been little ones popping up otherwise. I recently discovered Barnacles. Believe it or not,
great name.
Yeah, which is a link aggregation for small, self-funded businesses that find success on their own terms, which I thought was really interesting. Yeah. So obviously, it's kind of what happened, what they tried to do with, Stack Overflow, with all the different communities inside of Stack Overflow. But it was still very Stack Overflow-y, if that's a word. Where Lobsters, on the other hand, is like, no, it's all good. Like, Reddit tried to do it with their big ecosystem, and they kind of stayed inside the Reddit ecosystem. With SourceForge, that was Freudian.
That was a deep one.
Stack Overflow tried to do it, but kind of didn't really have the same kind of conversations that Reddit was having. Lobsters, on the other hand, was like, well, you know what? We'll just give it away, and we don't. You have sub organizations inside of it, but it's so easy to run because I believe it's just a Rails app. You just basically throw it out there, and it just starts up, and everything's there. So it seems pretty valuable. And to your point, it's very minimalist, where it's not like a bunch of stuff being thrown at you, and it's like upvotes. And then if, unlike me, very rarely do you get downvoted. So
I thought it was good. I think you should just dump your first account, call it a mulligan, and find a better username. This is a good poll. We'll link in the show notes because it's worth checking out. I'm over on their Pythonic News spinoff. So it's just Python-focused stuff, which I've been playing around with. And that's sweet. It's great to see, more open news aggregators for different nerdiness. Well, hell, JJ, we went across the spectrum. I think the takeaway is to appreciate the tools we have while we are very socially distant and emotionally distant from each other. Just the socially distant part.
There you go. I would like to try this one thing.
Okay, do it.
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Oh, so close.
So good. Next time. So close. Next time on the podcast, JJ meets all of our expectations with pronunciation. But until then, thanks for listening.
Yes, thank you.